Welcome to Better Cybersecurity, the ISF podcast. I'm your host, Steve Durbin.
ISF Chief Executive Steve Durbin is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today, Steve returns to business matters with Juliet Foster. The United Kingdom has a new Prime Minister, Andy Burnham, and Steve speaks with Juliet from a cyber and business perspective about what to expect from the nation's new leadership. They also discuss the importance of digital inclusion, what businesses should do to remain in control in times of uncertainty, cyber insurance, and more.
Hello, I'm Juliet Foster and welcome to Business Matters in association with the European magazine, first broadcast on Bloomberg TV in July 2026. Now, as the UK prepares for a change in leadership, many organisations are asking what this moment could mean for cyber resilience, digital inclusion and national security. Andy Burnham, the former mayor of Manchester, tipped to replace Sir Keir Starmer as Prime Minister, has long championed community-level access to technology and digital services. And while these themes have featured in Mr. Burnham's public thinking, they're also part of a much wider global conversation about cyber resilience and national capability. So what should an incoming leader prioritise in cybersecurity? How should digital inclusion shape national resilience? What should businesses do to stay secure and profitable during periods of political transition? Well, Steve Durbin is CEO of the Information Security Forum, a global independent authority on cyber risk and security best practice. He's spent years helping organisations navigate these very issues, and he joins me now in the studio. Steve, it is very good to see you. Welcome.
Thank you, Juliet. Nice to see you too.
Some interesting things are happening here in the UK because we're going through a period of transition. But in countries where that happens, organisations, understandably, are very worried because of all the uncertainty. So from your perspective, what are the immediate non-negotiable cyber priorities that an incoming leader must establish if he or she is to ensure that a nation maintains its resilience?
Defence has to be up there, doesn't it? That's one of the things that I think is really coming to the fore and lights being shone on that. And, you know, these are not trivial things. I would say that has to be there. And for a lot of people, of course, they may not quite understand why. Why is cyber so important when you look at it from a defence standpoint? And the answer to that is so much of what we do now is based on the technology. And
certainly Ukraine led the way on that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's been a masterclass, hasn't it, in how you can use drone technology, how you can use very sophisticated amounts of technology.
And it's often ordinary people who are operating some of this technology as well. It's not just the guys on the battlefield.
No, and that's another really good important point that we should make, because we talk all the time about lack of jobs and what AI is going to do in terms of taking away opportunities. Quite the opposite. Anybody can actually pick up some of these things. And one of the things that always makes me smile when I look at drone technology is that it's very akin to, and people probably won't like me saying this, but it's very akin to like playing with a PlayStation. So if you have grown up in that kind of era, then you're used to using that kind of technology. And so the route from a job perspective is there. And it isn't just drone technology that can be used in armed conflicts, of course. We use drone technology in other areas too. So not just confining it to conflict.
But look, this leads quite nicely into this whole point, which we've talked about before, and it's an ongoing point in its own right, and that is digital inclusion and community-level access to technology. Does that concept genuinely align with broader cyber strategies, or have we reached the stage now where it simply has to? There can be no lines of demarcation.
I don't think there can be any lines of demarcation anymore. I think digital inclusion is something that perhaps people don't fully understand. For a lot of people, digital inclusion means handing people a smartphone and saying, there you go. It isn't just about access. It's about the knowledge that you need to actually make use of the technology that you have access to. If we look at that within a government environment, it's a massive challenge for government. If you look at just HMRC, for instance, okay, so Revenue and Customs, looking to try to make tax digital, okay, they can provide the app, but they also have to make it so simple that anybody can use it. That's also digital inclusion. So it isn't just access points. It's how do we make it easy to use? How do we explain the why? We very often forget that. Why do you have to do this? Why do you have to have a form of cyber resilience? Why do you have to have a form of cyber defense? What are the consequences, in that example, at the individual level, of getting it wrong? That's really where we now need to be starting to spend our time, focusing on that. Some of the actual cyber infrastructure, the resilience, that has to be a given. So government has to be investing in that. But the other piece that very often we miss is the whole education. And that's where we have to start doing very much more in our schools.
Yeah, I'd like to follow through on that a little bit later. But do you feel that digital exclusion makes a country more vulnerable?
I do. If you talk to, let's take the Nordic countries, for instance. I remember not that long ago talking to a number of companies in the Nordics about the way in which they were digitally enabled. And they were very surprised to hear that, say, in the UK and some other countries, there wasn't that same degree of enablement. And I've talked a lot about this social exclusion, the digital gap, where people perhaps don't know how to do it. Or indeed, we mustn't forget that some of the demographic simply are afraid of using it. And again, it comes back to my point around education.
Okay, but look, is it now time for the government, whoever leads it, to make community-level access a critical part of a national cyber resilience strategy in general? Because you've argued the case to bring more people on board. It needs to go beyond simply knowing how to access, to fill out your tax form, etc. So is it now time to put it at the heart of that overall strategy?
I think it is. And I think it's because everything is moving to be digitally enabled. So if you don't do it at that level, then what you're doing is really consigning a whole piece of society to never being enabled, never being part of what everybody else has access to.
And perhaps vulnerable to manipulation from hostile actors.
Oh, absolutely. Because, of course, we have to remember that hostile actors will always go for the weakest link. And so it isn't just about bringing everyone up to the same level because that's the thing to do. There is also a national security component in this as well.
Let's look at the UK's Department for Science, Innovation and Technology, because given the vision that you've outlined, they're going to be at the heart of this.
Yes.
So what is it they should be doing right now to strengthen homeland cybersecurity as we, ordinary members of the public, wait to see who will be moving into Downing Street?
Yes, indeed. I think that they've done quite a lot. And I'm often very critical of government. I think this is one instance where they are actually doing some good things. They do have a number of different committees where they've really pulled in some experts in the field so that they're getting good advice. That's, again, one of the things I've talked about a lot, which is this combination of the public sector with the private sector. It doesn't matter where you sit. If you've got the right skill sets, you should be involved in it. And I think that they've done a very good job in that regard. Where I would be critical of them is I think that so far what they've done is focus on the more technical aspects. And that, for me, is like old school cyber. So we were doing that a number of years ago. We need now to be shifting, as I've been saying, to focus not just on that piece, but also on the people element, because that becomes the weakest link. And actually, the people piece is far more tricky to fix than the technical.
That comes back to the schools as well.
Exactly.
Okay, then. But look, let's look at cyber resilience within the wider context, because at the end of the day, we're involved in alliances like NATO and the Five Eyes, etc.
Yeah.
So how do these alliances actually shape our ability to respond to digital threats and hybrid warfare? I know that there is a geopolitical component, but moving away from that at the moment, on that administrative level, the relationship between the allies, how does that work?
For me, it's all about trust. It has to be about trust.
Is there enough trust at the moment?
I would say that it's certainly being tested. So you mentioned Five Eyes, for instance. The amount of sharing that goes on across there has been outstanding over the years. But it has to be formed on this basis of trust. So I think if you aren't investing appropriately, if you aren't the kind of country or government that is perhaps naturally sharing, perhaps naturally making a contribution, isn't seen to be at the table, that's a problem. And of course, everything moves so quickly in this space. So transitioning into that environment, I think, shouldn't be underestimated in terms of the not just the time, but the kinds of people that are able to do that. And government traditionally does tend to get bogged down in bureaucracy and administration. The way that technology is moving, the way that we have to respond to some of these emerging threats doesn't play well in that environment. Yeah. So you have to change that.
Yeah, you said that the sharing has been very good up till now. I guess that the flip side of that is that if somebody doesn't get their act together where it matters at the people level, then that's going to compromise the sharing. How much Absolutely. Should we give?
Yeah, and you get left behind. Because in this back to this whole trust thing, if I can't trust you, I'm not going to share the level that we used to. And so then the onus falls fairly and squarely on you to rebuild that level of trust. And I've now become very skeptical. I'm looking for evidence that will give me the encouragement that you've actually made that step. That could be in terms of the investment that you're making. It could be in terms of the sorts of people that you're putting on various committees and working with me on. So it's a whole variety of different things.
Let's look at the business perspective, because Look, we know that when you are going through this period of leadership transition, again, there is an enhanced uncertainty. But
yes.
What is it that the organizations themselves should be doing now to make sure that they can stay secure, profitable, and resilient, regardless of who forms the government or how long the process takes? Because that's the point. We don't know how long it's going to take. There's a lot of speculation, and that in itself is unhelpful.
It is unhelpful. And one of the big challenges with this whole uncertainty is that you really don't know how to plan from one day to the next. I think a lot of businesses were caught off guard when national insurance was increased a little while ago, for instance. That had a tremendous impact on small business in particular and their ability to hire, their ability to really roll out some of the plans that they'd had for growth.
And when they were under pressure to actually expand to help lift the economy.
Exactly. And we've seen that it's had the opposite effect, I would say. So what can businesses do in that environment? Well, they always fall back on focusing on what they can control. So they always fall back on their core business. They always fall back on having to try to protect certainly the assets that they've got in place, irrespective. But they have to be more agile as well. Mm. That's been the big lesson, I would say. Instead of perhaps planning on not certainties, but pretty good bets. What we're seeing is organizations moving much more to scenario-based planning. So let's take a few scenarios around this and let's plan accordingly. And then we can react with a pre-made plan for that certain scenario when it happens. You're always going to get something that comes from completely left field, as we've had over the past months. But at least you've got a number of different scenarios that you've worked through. And I think that is the key to it. It's this agility that you have inbred in the organization when you can't rely anymore on a stable environment.
And that is the interesting point, isn't it? Because in the UK, we've had nearly 7 prime ministers in a decade. We're about to get our 7th prime minister.
Yep.
Highly unusual in this country, but not perhaps quite so unusual in other countries. But the point is, it's a very unstable environment and more businesses are perhaps having to factor that in. So it's forcing a level of agility which might not otherwise have been there before.
Exactly. And you could argue that's a good thing because we have to be more agile. We have to be able to respond much more quickly. But the overall business environment that any government creates has to encourage inward investment. And if all of these agile businesses are saying, well, do you know what? There are probably some better bets out there. I'm going to go offshore and move away. And the same applies at the individual level, because let's not forget that the barrier to movement now has been significantly reduced, then you do run the risk of some of your smartest, brightest entrepreneurs and businesses leaving.
Yeah, there is this argument, and I'd love to get your take on this, that governments should operate more like businesses, and businesses should adopt some of the long-term planning of governments. Okay, interesting idea, particularly given the regularity with which some governments are changing, but how can you apply that to cyber strategy if we've got a little bit of role-playing happening here, that where perhaps people or institutions are behaving in a way which is a complete opposite of what we expect from them?
Yeah. I'm also sure that businesses should act like government. That
We're
really
changing
does.
Changing CEOs all the time.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that sort of sends shivers down my spine. I mean, but at the same time, I think that the point is that the challenge for business is that clearly you have to have some long-term goal, okay? We will all have those. But at the same time, you have to have the ability to be agile and respond in the moment. So you're talking about very short-term based. Now, I'm not a particular fan of moving towards what's traditionally been in the United States, where everything is driven around quarterly earning. I don't like that as an approach from a business standpoint. I do like the concept of rolling budgets, the fact that we've got multiple horizons that we're looking to try to deliver. So I'm a big fan of the McKinsey approach to horizon planning, where you've got multiple horizons. Yeah. That enables you to set future direction, but it also enables you to spend a significant proportion of your time focusing on the here and now without losing sight of some of those other future areas. And the beauty of it for me is you can apply that to people, you can apply it to product, to services, to expansion, to contraction, if that's going on as well. And you can simply overlay on that a number of different scenarios, such as the ones I've been talking about from the government standpoint as well, because businesses don't operate in isolation. That's the thing that's so important.
I mean, look, whenever we've had conversations in the past, we've always been talking about the major cyber incidents that have happened in recent months, how governments, indeed how companies themselves have been responding to them. But if you're going to take the broader view, what do these incidents tell us about the kind of leadership focus that the UK will need going forward? Once the Downing Street issue is resolved, so much is happening now in this hiatus period.
It is, and I'm not convinced that's a good thing. If you look at, let's look at it as if it's a takeover in the corporate world. You want to try to maintain a solid state in between somebody saying they're going to make the acquisition and take you over and when that completes. Mm. The last thing you want is a lot of moving pieces during that period, because then you're not actually buying what you thought you were buying. And that's really important for us to understand. So when it comes to cyber, cyber obviously is inbuilt in everything that we do these days. That, for me, is a given. If we're doing an assessment of our cyber resilience in an organization or in a government, it doesn't really matter. We need to be able to know that we've understood all of the moving parts and that they're not going to change for a certain period of time as we hand over that leadership baton to the next incoming Prime Minister, Chief Executive, whatever it may be. Because the resilience is core to the effectiveness going forward of that organization. All too often, there's a tendency to fiddle with it, play with it a little bit. No, we need to understand exactly what our core components are, the crown jewels. How are we protecting them? How are they going to be impacted over a certain period by any change that goes on? And what can we do to make sure that we're doing everything possible to preserve the integrity of those crown jewels so that we can continue to operate? The last thing you want is somebody coming in and actually changing that during a handover period.
Yeah. And
so it's a matter of discipline.
So this is the thing which is very worrying, because you understand what the definition of cyber resilience is.
Yes.
But I guess that the concern is, does the government?
Well, one would hope.
We'd hope, but are you worried that perhaps they don't know what that definition is because there's been so much change? The core is changing. It shifts.
I think you make a very good point. There's another piece that I'd add to that, and that is when you look at it from a government standpoint, very often there are some exceptionally large, ambitious technology or cyber-related projects that they have on the go at any one point in time. And I think if we want to be critical, it's that lack of understanding of all of the different moving parts. If we take the NHS as an example in the UK, we have NHS Wales, NHS England, NHS Scotland, with all of the associated doctors underneath that. Those three large component pieces do not talk to each other at a technology level. Some could say they're different entities. That's absolutely fine. Well, let's break it down even further. If you then look at it from the GP level, me as a user of an NHS app is supposed to be able to access all of my details online. It's a very good idea. Vast majority of people can't access it. Why? Because the GPs aren't uploading the information that's required. So then you will go to a hospital, they can't see the information. So for me, it isn't about the big idea. The big idea is very good. It's the implementation of it, and then back to getting people to use the thing. Because if you're not using it, there's no point in having it. But these are massive projects, billions of pounds that are going into this. Digital ID would be another one that keeps being bandied around. We have to get government back to the point of understanding the complexity of some of these very large projects and making sure they've got the best people able to work that through. And sadly, the UK's history in being able to get those sorts of projects off the ground and running effectively is not good.
You're leaning there into the cyber skills issue. I will address that in a moment, but let me give you one possible starting point to rebuild this core. And that is the idea that digital cyber needs to be treated as a fourth utility. We understand the importance of gas, electricity, and water. Digital. Yeah?
I think it does. I think it does. And there's an argument that says you actually reverse that order and you put digital first. Because all of those other things that you just talked about and mentioned are enabled by technology.
But you still have this core tech. So at the moment, it's just a trio.
Exactly. And it has to be there.
Okay. So look, you've talked about this skills, okay? Yeah. There is a serious cyber skills shortage.
Yes.
Businesses and governments need to work together to reverse it. How can they work together? And are we in the last chance saloon on this one?
Well, I think we have to look at it from the global perspective. The beauty of this is that, yes, there is a skills shortage. Nobody's arguing with that. But when we talk about how we can address that, we shouldn't just be looking at it within the UK. So we do have the whole world to go after from a skills perspective. Now, so do other countries, of course. But my point is that we shouldn't be constraining or confining ourselves to looking within our particular shores in the British Isles. So that's the market for us. So then what do we do? Well, we have to make sure that we've got some well thought through, very attractive skills programs that attract the right kind of people into the country. We have to have apprenticeship-based programs for homegrown skills development within the country. We have to create a tax environment that encourages some of these very smart people to want to come and work in the country. So there's a whole pile of different things that we begin to look at that isn't just about whether or not we've got the right skills framework. We have to create the right environment. That is the job of government. From a private sector standpoint, then I do think that there is a big role to be played by large organizations in terms of running these apprenticeship programs, internships, for instance. And I'm focusing very much on the entry level. I recognize that because that's where we're seeing such a challenge. And from a cyber-specific perspective, one of the things that has infuriated me constantly over the years is this obsession that we seem to have that people have to be trained in the technical skills in order to have a cyber career. Really? That is absolute nonsense.
Well, everybody is technically inclined, no, so to speak.
But it's nonsense anyway.
Yeah.
Because the sorts of skills that you need could equally be well found with people with arts degrees.
Yeah.
It's that curiosity.
Yes.
It's that ability to be able to be creative.
So we've actually got to put these two things back together because we fractured it.
Exactly, we have. And so when I hear governments talk about the fact that we need to be focusing very much more on, say, STEM versus the arts, for me, they've missed the point.
Yeah, because it also bleeds into the funding as well. But that's another part of the conversation.
Exactly.
We'll look at that another day. But look, I want to broaden things out in the time that's available and looking at insurance as well, because cyber insurance, it has tightened. Okay. Do you feel that perhaps the tougher position that insurers are taking, okay, means that they're going to be clamping down perhaps a little bit more robustly on the chief information security officers to actually take cyber risk more seriously? So can we actually see that feeding through to business practices?
I hope so. This, for me, is a key change in the way that business is being run. If we look back, you know, insurers have always had the ability to bring about change. And I welcome this focus on cyber insurance and the fact, much more importantly, that they're expecting people to adhere to certain policies, to certain standards. We're seeing them focus a little bit more on the fact that you need to be running simulation exercises so that you can demonstrate your ability to respond. It's long overdue, and as I say, I welcome it.
Yeah, and very important as well when you've got merger and acquisitions which are happening, because, okay, you're buying the company's assets, but you also need to know that the data side of things is safe. You don't want to be buying errors.
No, that's very true. And I think that's another area, certainly in the M&A space, where we need to be spending a little bit more time working through some of the cyber digital related due diligence, because it has been lacking up until now. There have been some horror stories over the years of people who bought organizations and suddenly discovered that there are all sorts of things that they hadn't really thought through.
Yeah, because that's what I was going to ask you as well. How do you think acquirers can be sure that the asset they're buying is as clean as the data room claims? Because if they say, yeah, it's fine, take it, that's down to trust. Trust is broken when you find that you've been sold a pump.
I think you do, in your acquisition process, you do have to have some very qualified, objective assessment done of exactly what it is that's making up this asset that you're buying and acquiring. And I think it's long overdue. All too often, of course, we haven't gone into that simply because of time. Acquisitions, mergers very often take a while to get to a certain point, and then it all accelerates as you go through that due diligence process to get the deal done. So I think it's about involving security people earlier in that process. I think it's about having a well-established set of steps that you go through, which I've outlined on other programs, to actually make sure that you can be as safe as possible and that you have at least an eyes-open approach to what's going on. Doesn't mean that there won't be problems, but you've got a better perspective on the areas that may be at risk for you, rather than assuming that the tech will simply work and that the digital piece will simply catch up. We need to be digging into that in as much detail as we do the financials, I would say.
Is it something that governments should be involved in? Obviously relates to where we are now, this transition period. Should governments be involved?
It's a very good question. I would say not at the moment. I think government has got enough to do in their own backyard.
Isn't this part of the importance? Because it still comes back to this issue of security. If a country has a very good security network, it makes it more saleable, more attractive.
Yes.
People want to do business with us.
Yes.
Trust.
Yes, it's a very good point that you make. However, the sort of the blunt tools that government tend to use tend to center around regulation and legislation. They always lag the market. And so in the kind of areas that we're talking about, I'm not convinced at the moment that's a helpful way to go. I'm much more in favor, as we were just talking, about people like the industry bodies coming in and doing that, because they're much closer to what's going on. And they have the ability to be able to flex much more readily and easily than, say, governments who might be introducing some form of legislation.
We do not know what's going to happen over the summer in terms of finding the new occupant of Downing Street. But do you feel that in itself, it presents a great opportunity for whoever comes in through the door to nail the cyber resilience issue once and for all? Don't let it slip through the fingers. Approach it sensibly, bring everybody on board, communities, business, others, to really make it work.
Clearly there's an opportunity. Whether or not the next incumbent chooses to grab it with both hands, we'll have to wait and see.
Do you feel that whoever it is understands the responsibility that cyber has moved on? It's no longer games on a console. It's very intricate. It's very involved. It embraces everything. Geopolitics, the movement in society, society's ability to work efficiently.
I would like to see a little bit more experience in government of people who do understand those things to give me the level of confidence that you're suggesting should potentially exist there. So if we can bring that about, absolutely fine. I look forward to it.
Sadly, we have run out of time, but Steve Durbin, CEO of the Information Security Forum, thank you so much for joining me. I'm Juliet Foster, and you've been watching Business Matters in association with the European magazine. One quick note before we go. We'll actually be away for our summer break, but we will be back in the autumn. See you then.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more expert insights and thought-provoking discussions. But in the meantime, if you really enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate, review, and share the podcast. If you're interested in becoming an ISEF member or continuing the conversation further, please do get in touch with me at steve.durbin@securityforum.org, or indeed get hold of me on LinkedIn. And remember, you can explore all our media and resources at our website, securityforum.org.